Chances are you're working from home a lot more these days. Hi, I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of Outside In, and if you're like me, you're driving much less. And perhaps you're wondering what to do with that old vehicle you no longer need. Well, you can donate it to NHPR and turn those many miles into shows that you love, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Outside In. We'll take care of the paperwork and arrange to have it picked up for free at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Access to health care in the United States depends in large part on health insurance, and politicians spend a lot of time on the campaign trail talking about its cost and its quality. Though the COVID-19 pandemic continues to dominate the headlines, the country's seemingly perpetual struggle to find a clear system for affordable health insurance continues to play out in this current election season. So today on The Exchange, how does the president influence health insurance policy, and what are the nominees saying? And what is the Supreme Court's role in health insurance? And listeners, tell us, is health insurance a big voting priority for you? And what are your biggest health insurance concerns? How is that impacting your vote? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests today, Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News and host of the podcast What the Health. Dan Gorenstein, Executive Producer and host of Trade-Offs, a podcast exploring our healthcare system. He previously worked as a reporter for NHPR. And Ryan Levy, Producer of Trade-Offs, which has broken down candidate proposals on health insurance, drug costs, and the pandemic. Thank you, everybody, for being on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And we're going to start the program today by talking a little bit about the courts, what the court's role in health policy is. And we'll start with the Supreme Court and the conversation happening now around a case known as Texas v. California. That's the case scheduled to be discussed before the court a week after the election. Julie Robner, you've been covering this before you knew it would be such a big deal. So what's at the center of this case?
That's right. I went to the original press conference where the case was announced. It was filed by 20 Republican, mostly attorneys general, a couple of governors, after Congress passed the 2017 tax bill, which included a provision that reduced the penalty for not having health insurance to zero. And what the Republican attorneys general argued is that without the penalty, there was no tax. Without the tax, the justification that the Supreme Court had in 2012 for upholding the law was gone, and therefore the entire law is now unconstitutional. Now, even people who'd been part of the earlier cases challenging the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act thought this was kind of a dubious argument, but they found a federal district court judge in Texas who agreed with them. And it went up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and there was a three-judge panel. And two of the three judges said, well, maybe not the whole law has to go, but generally, yeah, we think at least the requirement to have health insurance without a penalty is unconstitutional. So they sent it back to the lower court to have the judge say, maybe the whole law doesn't have to go after all. And in the meantime, blue states intervened and said, we would like the Supreme Court to resolve this sooner because it could take a couple of years otherwise. And the Supreme Court took the case earlier this spring, but they decided not to hear it and decided in the spring, they decided to hear it in the term that started October 1st, and it will be heard on November 10th.
Okay. And you mentioned that this is not the first time the Affordable Care Act has come up for discussion before the Supreme Court. What are some notable examples of previous discussions the Supreme Court has had about the ACA?
Well, obviously, the big case was in 2012, or that's when the Supreme Court decided it. The case was actually filed the day after the Affordable Care Act was signed. In fact, it might have been filed the actual day the Affordable Care Act was signed, again, by Republican lawmakers and state officials and the NFIB. So that case is known as NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business, a small business lobbying group. And they charged that Congress did not have the authority to require most people to have health insurance. And what the Supreme Court decided in 2012, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, was that that penalty for not having insurance was within Congress's taxing power, and therefore the law was constitutional. There was another big challenge, not quite as existential as the one in 2012. In 2015, that had to do with some sloppy way the law was written. So it involved whether or not the subsidies that you can get when you buy your own insurance, if you earn less than 400% of poverty, whether those are available nationwide or only in health insurance exchanges that are run by actual states, of which there are more of them now, but at the time there were only about a dozen. And that was Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy joined the liberals in saying that, yeah, Congress may not have written this in the neatest way, but yes, the subsidies are available to everyone.
Okay. And I want to direct this next question to Dan Gorenstein, and it has to do with the ERISA law. This is different from the ACA, but so many things with healthcare are intertwined. And this has also been before the Supreme Court, or will be soon. Dan, can you tell us a little bit about ERISA, what it is and what the challenge is?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Peter. ERISA is the reason why this matters so much is that states like New Hampshire and others have tried to reform state laws around increasing price transparency or trying to regulate so-called drug middlemen known as pharmacy benefit managers. And what has happened over the last couple of decades is that the large employers have really this is a complicated one, Peter.
I know. I'm sorry. I asked you such a hideously broad question because it's such a complicated thing. And I know, Julie Robner, you've covered this too. So jump in if you need to, but feel free to continue, Dan.
Yeah. So basically, what you've got is you have these you've got employers who are really trying to. Actually, Julie, let me pass this one to you. If you can just pick this up for a quick
second. Let's start with what ERISA is. ERISA is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And it was a retirement bill that Congress passed in 1972, I believe. And at the very last minute, they threw health insurance into it. So there's only like a line about health insurance in the entirety of ERISA, which is basically how the federal government regulates retirement programs. I mean, it's a huge, important, complicated law. But because it says so little about health insurance, except that health insurance is to be regulated, that basically everything that we know about ERISA has gone through the courts because the courts have had to interpret all of this. It's a really important law because it effectively says that large employer health plans can't be regulated by the states. They will be regulated by the federal government, by the Department of Labor through ERISA. So most people don't even know this, that they have health insurance and they think that they can go to their state, you know, insurance, regulator, and the state official will say, I can't do anything about it because your health plan is not regulated by the state, it's regulated by the federal government. So that's sort of what creates, that's why there's so many ERISA cases in the courts, because it's basically all court-made law effectively at this point.
Why do laws like this, healthcare policy laws, end up in the courts so frequently, as opposed to, say, lawmakers simply rewriting something in Congress or passing something new? Why are the courts such a pivotal role here?
Well, I think it varies. I mean, some of it is that in the case of presidential actions, what they end up in court over are sort of two things. Did the executive branch have the authority to do this? That's about, I would say about half the cases are that they didn't have, charging that they don't have the authority to do that. The other half of the cases are basically saying, did they follow the Administrative Procedure Act, which is how regulations are required to be promulgated by the federal government? There's an enormous set of hoops that you have to jump through, and frequently administrations, Democratic and Republican, miss one of those hoops, and people who oppose whatever rule is coming out will say you didn't do X or you didn't do Y, and they'll go to court and the courts will say yes, you must follow the Administrative Procedure Act. So there's sort of those are the two main reasons why things end up in court, but essentially it's because they can't get what they want from the legislature. In terms of healthcare, at least at the federal level, the legislature's been stuck. The Affordable Care Act passed in 2010 in March, and in November The Republicans took back over the Congress, and or at least the House. And so it became very difficult to get anything through Congress to fix some of the obvious glitches in the law. Normally, you would have sets of what they call technical corrections, where things would be, you know, things that were miswritten or things that they'd left out or things that just didn't work out the way they expected would be adjusted. I've covered, you know, dozens of technical corrections bills. Some of them are pretty big and pretty important. There has not been a set of technical corrections essentially for the Affordable Care Act. There was a bill in 2015 that sort of fixed some other things and went back and got some of the Affordable Care Act glitches resolved. But mostly the Republicans have kind of held the Affordable Care Act hostage. And therefore, everything else about the Affordable Care Act tends to end up in court.
Okay. Listeners, if you've got questions about the intersection of the courts and healthcare policy, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And later in the program, we're going to be talking about the presidential candidates and their policy positions on health care. And we'll talk about the executive branch in general and how much power the executive branch does have when it comes to setting health care policy. Again, questions about any of those things, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Julie Robner, tell us about the Supreme Court as it's currently composed right now. There are 8 justices with Amy Coney Barrett likely to be confirmed sooner rather than later, it seems. What implications do you think that has for healthcare policy?
Well, they're enormous. I mean, it's hard to overstate the implications here. Basically, what you have right now are 4 conservatives, 3 liberals, and the Chief Justice, who appears to be very concerned about the standing of the court with the public, the legitimacy of the court. Therefore, the Chief Justice, who is no fan of abortion rights, actually joined the liberals in an abortion case back in June because it was too close to a case that the court had decided in 2016, on which he'd been on the losing side. He'd been on the anti-abortion side of that case in 2016, but because the law in question, this was a law out of Louisiana, was so similar to the law out of Texas that had been struck down, the Chief Justice said he felt bound by precedent to also strike down the Louisiana law. So the Chief Justice is basically the swing vote here. But if there's a Justice Barrett who joins them, the Chief Justice won't be able to swing anything anymore, because then it will be 5 conservatives, 3 liberals, and the Chief Justice. So, you know, things that might steer more of a middle course, even if there was a 4th liberal, when you'd still have sort of 4 liberals, 4 conservatives in the chief, now you'll have 5 conservatives, 3 liberals in the chief, and who knows what could happen.
Mm-hmm. And
right. And go ahead, Peter, let me jump in here. I mean, if the ACA is struck down, the case is going to be heard the Tuesday after the election, then there could be massive implications for people. The Urban Institute came out with a report just this week that found about 21 million people nationwide would be uninsured by 2022. You'd see a drop in Medicaid by 15 million people. Federal government spending on healthcare would fall by about $152 billion a year by 2022. There's a lot we can unpack here, but I think, you know, what is clear is that the Affordable Care Act has sort of redefined what health insurance is, and striking this law down would have a huge ripple effect to people who have insurance through their employers, which about 150 million Americans do, as well as people who are buying insurance on their own through the exchanges, or also people on Medicaid.
And if the Affordable Care Act is struck down, Dan, is it struck down immediately? And do people lose their health insurance immediately? Or do the people who already have health plans just have them until some other kind of event occurs?
Well, I think this probably would depend in some part on what the ruling is and if the court has the authority to have some sort of unwinding period of time. So that is probably the answer. But if this were struck down immediately, we would see these repercussions begin, I think, almost immediately. Julie might have more details.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear. I mean, people, and this has been pointed out to me, people will have contracts for health insurance. It's, in all likelihood, this decision comes down sometime in 2021, probably in the middle of 2021. People who'd signed up for health insurance would still have that health insurance, but the subsidies that they get, the help from the federal government to pay those premiums, would likely stop immediately. Remember, this is a constitutional challenge. It's not like the court can say, we think this should stop as of January 1st next year. Congress can do that. But the court, if court says it's unconstitutional, all the money stops flowing. And so a lot of those people would still have health insurance, but no longer be able to pay for it. Similarly with Medicaid, the federal Medicaid money would stop flowing. States could keep those people on the Medicaid, on their Medicaid rolls, but the states would have to pay for it. And that would get very expensive because the federal government is paying 90% of the cost of that expansion population. So it would be, and it's not just the people who directly get their insurance from the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act made huge changes to how drugs are approved, how Medicare is run, health professionals are trained. There are just, it's an enormous and sweeping law that was way bigger than just the, you know, requirement that most people have health insurance or pay a fine. And all of that would go with it if the court does what the lawsuit is asking.
So Ryan Levy, let me ask you a question about the election and what this would mean. I mean, it looks that the Democrats will have a strong showing in the November election nationwide. If they are elected to both the executive branch and the Congress, if they control Congress, would they be able to provide some kind of backstop if the ACA is in fact struck down by the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So. They'll have a few options. You know, one, since as Julie explained, you know, this lawsuit is kind of based on the zeroing out of that of the penalty for not having health insurance. You know, folks have said they could put that up to $1 or remove that from the law, so it's not kind of, you know, the linchpin of the law. And they could make some of these other changes to the Affordable Care Act or pass. You know, Joe Biden has very big plans for healthcare that he wants to enact. So, you know, they could pass some new things that would, in their say, hopefully stand up to constitutional muster. So they certainly, if they have the ability to pass new legislation, certainly they do have some more tools to kind of deal with a potential negative ruling from the Supreme Court. And I think it's also worth pointing out, you know, as Julie's talking about all of the kind of, you know, the sweeping way that the ACA affects so many people, there is also a chance that the Supreme Court could rule that because Congress zeroed out the penalty for the individual mandate, that part is unconstitutional, but that doesn't mean that the whole law has to go down like the plaintiffs are asking for here. And so, you know, we could see that the individual mandate goes and maybe some other parts that the court decides are kind of really tied to that part of the law, but we could still see the rest of the law staying put. And again, that's just kind of the uncertainty that we have here of what this case could mean. It could have these really huge sweeping effects that Julie talked about, or it could be a little more narrow in terms of its impacts.
What's kind of ironic about if the court had a sort of a less broad interpretation, what the Trump administration originally asked for, they're now asking that the whole law be overturned. But their original position was that, no, the whole law doesn't have to go, but just the things, as Ryan said, that are sort of intimately connected to the requirement to have health insurance. But those things are guaranteed issue and community rating, which basically translate to protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So ironically, the most unpopular thing and the most popular thing were tied together. That would be not as big a dislocation for the entire health system, but it would certainly be a political problem if the pre-existing condition protections were struck down by the Supreme Court. So even a more limited ruling could have enormous political implications.
So what should we be watching out for in the coming months regarding health insurance cases at the Supreme Court? We'll start with you, Julie.
Well, obviously, the Affordable Care Act case is the big case, and to see, you know, how the oral arguments go. Obviously, you know, does Justice Barrett get on the court? It certainly looks like it as of this moment, but You know, it's been a very unpredictable year. There are some other cases. There are a number of reproductive health cases also making their way to the Supreme Court. So there's a lot to watch.
Dan, what about you? What will you be looking for most in the next few months?
Well, certainly, I mean, this ACA case covers the sun in a way, mm-hmm. but I think as we talked about at the outset, this ERISA case has a significant impact for, you know, as Julie alluded to, we're not seeing Congress really be very functional when it comes to passing laws. They're not even able to compromise on how to sort of tweak and modify the Affordable Care Act. And so what has happened, Peter, is that you see states have become these laboratories where there's all the kind of health reform innovation happening on the ground. And depending on the ruling in this ERISA case, if the ruling is in favor of employers, that could even further handcuff states' ability to try innovative ideas to help lower costs and improve care.
And how about you, Ryan, going forward, what will you be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the ACA case, and then to your point from your question, you know, whoever wins the election and whatever Congress looks like, you know, obviously the Democrats, if they get in, they will be trying to do a lot of stuff around healthcare and health insurance. But even if President Trump is reelected or Republicans have some power in Congress, you know, they've been saying that they're going to come up with protections for pre-existing conditions. And so, it will really be on them, especially if the ACA is struck down, to follow through on that and actually come up with a plan to protect these conditions, to continue these protections that are so popular and so baked into our system at this point.
We're speaking about health insurance today on The Exchange. And listeners, we'll talk more after a short break about what the executive branch can do. And we want to hear about your concerns regarding health insurance as well. Tell us your story. What does health insurance mean to you? What do you want to see from the government with respect to making health insurance more affordable and of better quality? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for tuning in. Along with COVID-19, access to health care via quality health insurance is top of mind for many voters this election season. And with November 3rd fast approaching, we're taking a close look at the avenues our various branches of government can and do take to change the way we gain access to doctors and other medical professionals. With us today, Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News and host of the podcast What the Health. Dan Gorenstein, Executive Producer and host of Trade-Offs, a podcast exploring our health care system. He previously worked as a reporter for NHPR. And Ryan Levy, producer of Trade-Offs, which has broken down candidate proposals on health insurance, drug costs, and the pandemic. Your questions are welcome here. What do you hope for in a health care policy? And which candidate best articulates what you want? Tell us about your situation and what would best help you. Email exchange@nhpr.org. But for quickest access, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And we got this note from someone who wanted to remain anonymous. The question was, why have insurance? Insurance companies have been allowed to charge huge premiums and huge deductibles and huge out-of-pocket costs. Seems like we are paying for all of our health care. Government doesn't seem to be helping to keep it affordable. And this caller, who didn't want to stay on the line but remained anonymous, says they were still paying for an operation that took place a year and a half ago with many surprise billings. So maybe we'll start with you, Ryan Levy. What do you think? Why have insurance in the first place, according to this listener wants to know?
Well, I'm obviously very sorry for that listener's experience, you know, and I think there are a lot of folks who are dealing with, you know, certainly the healthcare system, the health insurance system is not perfect and does not work for a lot of people. But I think when you talk to economists and when you talk to kind of the folks who study this, you know, one of the big reasons for health insurance ideally is it's a financial protection. you know, it is something so that if you, you know, you're paying in so that when you get sick and you are hit with these, you know, really huge, potentially huge medical bills, that that doesn't bankrupt you, that, you know, you are able to kind of continue your life and you're able to pay for those bills with help. Obviously, that does not always work. And there are lots of examples of that. But that, you know, is really the goal. And I think one interesting thing to point out, the caller mentioned, you know, about not seeing that much help from the federal government. I don't know the exact stat off the top of my head, Julie might, but I know that, you know, through the ACA, a large portion of folks do get subsidies from the Affordable Care Act, from the federal government to help pay for it.
85% of
there
people.
You go, I knew okay. thank you, Julie. And so, you know, a lot of folks are getting that support from the government to help pay for their insurance costs. Obviously, they are still too high for so many people. And that's, you know, one of the kind of the big things that drives this entire conversation is how do we keep insurance? How do we make insurance affordable so that it's not bankrupting folks, so that it's not, so that it actually acts as that tool to keep folks, you know, kind of financially secure, as opposed to just, you know, adding another big bill to their plate.
And Julie Robner, the question from the caller strikes me as kind of a philosophical one, right? Like, why do we have insurance? Well, maybe as a country, the United States has philosophically liked to privatize things whenever possible. And so health insurance is a private solution to all, make healthcare affordable at perhaps very expensive hospitals. Am I far off base in your estimation?
No, you're not far off base. And this is a persistent philosophical debate in healthcare that we've had for the last century, basically, since, you know, health insurance first started. And there is an argument that if we did not have third party coverage, i.e. insurance or employers paying for people's healthcare, that healthcare might be less expensive. And the people who argue this point to things that insurance typically doesn't cover, like laser eye surgery and cosmetic surgery. On the other hand, both of those things are pretty expensive for the average person, and obviously they are not required. I mean, you could argue, and probably would be true, that if we didn't have third-party coverage and particularly generous insurance, people might use less healthcare, and healthcare would almost certainly cost less than it does now, because otherwise people wouldn't be able to get it if they had to pay with their own money. On the other hand, the technological advances that we've seen in medical care mean that healthcare is going to be expensive, and most people are not going to be able to afford it, and hence that's why we have insurance. And that is, I mean, this is sort of the one of the divides that underlies the difference between, you know, Democrats and Republicans. Republicans basically say we should let the market work more and have less government regulation. And Democrats say, no, healthcare is a right and a necessity and the government should do more. And so where we end up with is in this sort of dysfunctional middle that we can't seem to break out of.
Thank you very much for that. And listeners, if you have questions, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the executive branch and the power that the executive branch has to change or initiate healthcare policy. What role does the president have, Julie Robner, in healthcare policy, specifically health insurance policy? What can the president do, we'll say, without Congress?
The president can do quite a lot. As we talked about earlier in regards to the courts, the president, you know, the executive branch has administrative power. The Congress makes the laws and the executive carries them out. And in order for the executive to carry out the laws, they put out rules and regulations and guidance and other sorts of things. But basically, they interpret how the laws are to be carried out. And then, of course, the court's referee, if the court says that's not really what Congress intended. But there is a good bit of executive power. I would say I've been covering every administration since the very tail end of the Reagan administration. And presidents, Democratic and Republican, have been pushing that executive power in healthcare and in other things more and more, and trying, you know, basically, I think in the eyes of a lot of political scientists, actually usurping a lot of legislative power, doing things that Congress really wouldn't have intended, or as we talked about with healthcare, just can't get done. This president has, you know, who's broken a lot of norms, has pushed things a whole lot further. And most of those things are currently in court. Some of them are, you know, heading towards the Supreme Court. There's there doesn't seem to be a lot of question that the president cannot, as he would like to do, tie Medicare drug prices to the price-controlled prices in other countries. And yet he's getting ready to put out a rule that would do just that, and it will almost certainly be challenged in court. Now, the wild card here is how many judges President Trump has put on the bench, and the fact that they are all very conservative. Does conservative mean that they're going to side with the executive over Congress? We don't know that, but it will be interesting to sort of see how this all plays out.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to executive orders, I mean, President Trump recently signed an order designed to protect people with pre-existing conditions, but his critics say the executive order was meaningless. In your estimation?
I think that one really is meaningless.
Yeah.
The president, in the order, it basically just says it's the policy of the federal government that people with pre-existing conditions will be able to buy affordable insurance, but there is no way to carry that out. I mean, that some of these things are actual, you know, so a lot of these rules say you will do this, and there are pages and pages of how you will do this, and those are the ones that they argue over, but that one is basically a press release.
Mm-hmm. And Dan Gorenstein, your thoughts on the political makeup of Congress? I mean, does it matter which party holds the House and Senate with respect to what the president can or attempts to do?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, if Donald Trump is reelected and the Democrats continue to hold the House, which they're widely expected to do, obviously, President Trump, if he wants to push through any sort of legislation, is going to have to get the cooperation of Democrats. And Democrats, there is some possibility, there is some overlap in certain areas around some of the ideas around trying to make prescription drugs more affordable is something that both the president and the House leadership have discussed. I think that there's also, you know, clearly a lot of interest among Democratic leaders in the House around protecting people with pre-existing conditions. So if the ACA was to be struck down and President Trump was continued to be in office, you could imagine Pelosi and her team working hand in glove with the administration if there was a serious reform effort there.
We're getting listener questions, so I'd love to get some of those folks on the air. Let's talk to Steve in Bow. Steve, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air. What's your question?
Thank you, guys. I appreciate you guys having this discussion. I know one of the things that's always been in the forefront of my mind when we talk about health insurance or health care or whatever you want to refer to it as is the who's keeping the providers in check, making sure that the providers are not billing anything egregious or billing anything over and above a usual amount. I realize most of the times it's the insurance company, but then when the insurance company fights back and says, you know, this is too much to bill for this procedure, then it's kind of a fight back and forth, and it's almost like nobody wins. I guess who's keeping the providers in check and making sure that the providers are billing accurately in accordance to the services that are performed?
Thank you very much, Steve. Really appreciate the question. Turn it to the panelists. Does anybody have a particular answer to this?
Yeah, actually, journalists are doing a lot of this right now. We have a Kaiser Health News and NPR have a bill of the month where people send us their outrageous medical bills, and we sort of usually in telling the story, providers tend to back down. Sarah Cliff, now at the New York Times, has been doing this with emergency room bills. I mean, obviously, state insurance departments have a role to play and are, but Congress has been trying to do something about some of the sort of the more egregious bills, if you will, for some time, and basically has not been able to come up with a solution because there's this sort of intra health industry fight between health insurance providers and insurers about who's going to pay if the bill's not going to get stuck with the patient, and they haven't been able to come up with that. And so but I think this is one of the things that is definitely making the public more and more frustrated with the state of health insurance in the United States, which is to say, even if you have health insurance, you can still be bankrupted by medical bills. That's not how insurance is supposed to work.
So you said that journalists are keeping them in check, maybe public shaming with articles of egregious mistakes or efforts to harm consumers. State legislatures or insurance, state insurance departments is what you said, Julie.
Yeah, state insurance departments, agencies. Occasionally, state attorneys general in sort of cases of illegal types of billing or bill collecting. But, and employers and insurers obviously Are you know, there are places that people can go to turn to for help, but it's a huge problem. I mean, you know, people who basically make money for a living as opposed to delivering healthcare are getting into the healthcare industry because there's so much money in it, and basically turning what used to be healthcare providers have always needed to make money to stay in business, but there are now people who basically are going into healthcare in order to basically squeeze every dime out of it for, stockholders. Mm-hmm. And that's become a problem really in the last decade or so.
And so,
Peter,
go ahead, please jump in.
If I could jump. One other thing, you know, specifically around these, you know, surprise bills that Julie is talking about. This is something that some state legislatures have passed laws to try and, you know, kind of get into the game so that they can try to kind of be this referee or try to kind of protect consumers so that they're not facing these huge bills that sometimes they're seeing from providers. But, you know, there's a limit to how far those laws can go because of ERISA, which we talked about earlier, because those laws don't apply to, you know, the more than half of folks who have, mostly employer-sponsored insurance that is kind of, you know, covered by ERISA. And so it really does come down to Congress needing to pass some laws that address these issues to really provide relief kind of for all folks who have insurance. And again, this is, you know, to Dan's point earlier, you know, this is one of the areas, you know, both Republicans and Democrats have said they want to do something about surprise billing. It's one of the few actual kind of specifics in President Trump's kind of healthcare plan. He doesn't say how he would do it, but he says he wants to deal with it. And so this is another area that you would hope coming soon we would see some congressional action on, although we have not seen anything to date.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is, if you want change in the ways of billing, look to congressional candidates, not necessarily the president of the United States.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go.
This is something that needs to be basically fixed legislatively.
Okay. Let's talk to Jill in Sandwich. Thanks for calling, Jill. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. I am wondering. It seems like you have the little guy who has the insurance that is exorbitant. And then as you go up the line, like other callers have said, the doctors are charging too much. Pharma is ripping us off dry. The insurance companies are underpaying. The hospitals are overcharging. So in a capitalist society, I know this is rather difficult, but how does the government intervene and stop all of the ripping off and overcharging and underpaying that's going on, as opposed to just expanding what is available? I mean, no one would have to be paying so much if we weren't being somewhat ripped off to begin with. Does that make
how can the government expand when there's so much profit motive baked into the cake?
Well, basically, yes. The profit motive makes everything beyond what an insurance policy can really cover. It just becomes exorbitant for the little guy, but all of the overcharging is beyond everyone's control.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the call, Jill. Yeah, the capitalist influence in all of this, it's pervasive, and that's the society we live in. What do you say to that, Julie? Do you have a comment?
Yeah, this is the continuing argument going back to the original question about, you know, why should we have insurance? Mm-hmm. In Medicare, the government takes care of by basically setting prices. You know, Medicare says this is how much we're going to pay for X. And if someone is sicker than average, we'll pay an additional amount. Or if you're in a rural area, we'll pay an additional amount because the hospitals are not very large and most of the patients are Medicare. I mean, Medicare payment is hugely complicated. What hospitals in particular, and doctors to a lesser extent, will say is that Medicare doesn't pay enough, and therefore we have to overcharge everybody else to make up for what Medicare pays. But this is basically the issue. Is there anybody to say this is the right amount, and that's too much, and that's too little? And it's funny, there was, you know, we've had over the years efforts to have boards of experts determine what is the right amount, and politics has always sort of gotten in the way of making that happen. England has basically such a board, And they are called, you know, they're called a rationing board because they will say that, well, this drug is too expensive and doesn't provide enough of a benefit to justify its price. And therefore, we're not going to pay for it through the National Health Service. So, you know, there's an enormous pushback to making things, quote unquote, affordable. But I mean, right now, it really is just sort of, you know, what anybody can get away with. And, you know, would it be good for insurers to maybe push back a little harder? That might help. And to some extent they do. And in some, you know, sort of closed insurance networks, Kaiser Permanente, to name one, it's a little bit easier because they're controlling both the insurance and the providers, but most people are not in sort of closed model HMOs. And so we have this possibility of you have insurance, but it might not cover what you want.
Well, you know, go ahead, Dan.
Insurers do try to push back. And I think one of the interesting tensions that I've learned as a healthcare reporter here is that consumers really kind of want it all. You know, you want to pay the lowest possible price. You want to sort of limit your out-of-pocket spending, but at the same time, you want access to whatever coverage you want when you want it, and you want it right then. And like, that's a fundamental tension. And I think that more consumers need to kind of be honest about trying to want basically everything, but for free. And there's some ideas in health policy where if you were to, you know, as Julie said, right, a lot of this is about the price. How much should we be charging for anything from a routine checkup to getting some angioplasty or what have you. And I think that, there's a trade-off here that some, at least this is the sort of current thinking among health economists, is the idea that if the federal government were to do more to rein in prices and make all this stuff more affordable to everybody, you would end up potentially losing some innovation. And so earlier in our conversation, we've talked about some of the, you know, medical miracles. I mean, like at some point now, cancer, for certain sorts of cancers, it's a chronic condition. It had been a death sentence and now it's a chronic condition. We might lose some of that innovation if we rein in the prices. At least that's the sort of operating theory. And so that's another tension to consider in all of this.
All about trade-offs, as you mentioned. Dan Gorenstein, executive producer and host of Trade-Offs. We're speaking with him. We're also speaking with Ryan Levy, producer of Trade-Offs, and Julie Robner, chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News and host of the podcast, What the Health. We'll have more with our guests about the major party presidential candidates and their policies, trying to make promises on the campaign trail. And will they deliver? Can they deliver? What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been talking about health insurance in this hour and the government policies intended to expand access to it and lower its costs. There is vast disagreement between the two major party presidential candidates, incumbent Republican Donald Trump and challenger former Vice President Democrat Joe Biden. We're going to take some time in this part of the program spelling out the differences in their policies, and we'd love to hear from you. What were you really hoping to hear from the candidates? Where have the candidates failed to fully explain themselves or their policies? Our panelists have been keeping a close eye on presidential health care policy. They're Julie Robner, chief Washington correspondent at Kaiser Health News, Dan Gorenstein, executive producer and host of Trade-Offs, and Ryan Levy, producer of Trade-Offs. Again, if you've got questions, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's start this part of the program with a call from Peyton. Peyton, thank you very much for calling. You're calling from Durham. Thank you very much.
Hey, great show, and thanks for covering this. Hey, I just wanted to share a story that I've kind of just recently been through. My dad was 82, and he was living up in Canada in Nova Scotia, and he had a stroke last November. And so they called, and they said he had a stroke, and they were taking him to the local regional hospital. And then so I started driving up there, and then midway, they went to Halifax Hospital. So when I arrived, he was in the neuro ICU in Halifax, which, you know, looks like the state-of-the-art hospital you would see in Boston or anywhere else. You know, that was a small ward, a lot of nurses. Everyone was in a single bed. I mean, it's an ICU for, you know, brain injuries, but that was really professional, and everyone there was unbelievable. And, you know, they had a chat with us, and they said, you know, if you're a Canadian, this is all free. You know, you'd walk out of here without a bill. But since you're a U.S. citizen, your dad's a U.S. citizen, this is, you know, a $15,000 day room. And, you know, so there were insurance implications of that. After, you know, 3 days there, they transferred him back to his regional hospital where he, you know, near where he lives. And then he spent 2 weeks there while they stabilized him so that we could transport him back to the States. And you know, I spent 3 weeks inside those hospitals. And for me, I was sort of blown away because you start viewing the doctors and the entire hospital complex as like an internal national security ward for the citizens, where you're like, they're really protecting the citizens. They're trying to get them healthy, stabilize them, and then move them on into the next area of the system. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was, you know, really like, wow, this is very different. And then we finally got him back to the U.S. And then I had the, you know, I think what everyone goes through, 6 months of dealing with insurance plans and providers here trying to get that reimbursed so that, that we could get the Canadian system paid. And that was, you know, next to impossible. And I do, you know, complicated things every day. That was really, really, really almost impossible. It was one thing after another. So it's just the stark contrast between, boy, if he was Canadian citizen, he walked out of there with no bill. You just, they wheel you out and they move you to maybe your rehab. But, you know, here the experience I've had is just super complicated, super expensive.
Yeah. Well, I have to let you go, Peyton, but I sympathize with your story. It's a story we've heard in various forms as healthcare policy is discussed, because the elephant in the room is that, you know, there are governments funded healthcare systems across the world, and stories like yours that seem to suggest that citizens living under those governments have an easier time managing their own healthcare. That said, we are going to focus this part of the program on the plans basically on the ballot this November, with the two candidates we have who are whatever you think of it, working within the system of health insurance that we have right now. Do appreciate your comments, though, Peyton. Thank you very much for calling. We want to take a look first at President Trump's policies. Then we'll talk about Joe Biden's policies to wrap up the show. And if you have questions or comments, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Now, let's take a look at President Trump's plans, and let's let him explain them first and then break them down according to the details. Here's President Trump in late September laying out his America First healthcare plan.
In short, we're delivering better care with more choice at a much lower cost and working to ensure Americans have access to the care they need. My plan expands affordable insurance options, reduces the cost of prescription drugs, will end surprise medical billing, increases fairness through price transparency, streamlines bureaucracy, accelerates innovation, strongly protects Medicare, and always protects patients with pre-existing conditions.
Okay, so that's President Trump laying out his America First health care plan. Ryan Levy, you've been following the proposals of the major party candidates. What are the hallmarks of how President Trump intends to do this if he's given another 4 years as president?
So that is a question that a lot of people have been asking. I think, you know, we just heard kind of a list of things that to a lot of people probably sound really good. But as always in health policy and in you know, governing in general, the devil is in the details. And we haven't seen a lot of details about kind of how President Trump would do that, especially when it comes to protecting pre-existing conditions, which, as we've talked about, is this really big topic here. But in terms of kind of, you know, what he talked about at the beginning, you know, one of the big pieces, kind of the hallmarks of the president's philosophy around healthcare is this idea of choice and competition. And so he has really, over the course of his administration, through many of these administrative actions that Julie talked about earlier, done things to basically give folks more choices of healthcare options. And by choice, these are usually things that do not comply with all of the rules and requirements of the Affordable Care Act. You know, the Affordable Care Act says you have to, you know, cover pre-existing conditions. You have to cover, you have to pay for certain kind of what are called essential health benefits, things like maternity care, mental health. But there are some, you know, some loopholes and some kinds of coverage that don't have to comply with that. And he has really tried to make those more accessible. These are
the short-term plans, right?
Short-term, yes, exactly. Short-term plans, which she is very fond of, as well as association health plans. So those, that's kind of, you know, I think, you know, based on our reporting, you know, when you really look at what he has actually done and tried to do, it has really been about making it easier for folks to get these coverage that, yes, is cheaper. You know, the premiums on these kinds of plans are cheaper, but what you're getting for that, you're getting less for that money. You are getting less coverage. You are not getting all the protections that the ACA was passed to put into place for folks.
Mm-hmm. And what about protecting Medicare and Medicaid? Is that something that the president is laying out details on something on what he wants to do?
No, not that I have seen. I mean, on Medicaid, you know, he has had plans to really fundamentally change how Medicaid works. Instead of having, you know, the federal government matching whatever states pay, whatever states are paying for their Medicaid patients, you know, instead, basically the federal government, he would want to give them just a set amount of money to kind of do with as they will and cover the Medicaid patients in their state as they will. A lot of people worry that that would lead to less coverage and less benefits for the people on Medicaid. And obviously trying to overturn the ACA would get rid of the Medicaid expansion. On Medicare, we've heard very little. You know, the president has liked to say, you know, going back to 2016, that he's going to protect Medicare. You know, he tried to kind of draw a line in the sand between him and other Republican candidates on that. So he was always going to protect Medicare. But, you know, we're looking at in the next presidential term, a chunk of the Medicare program is going to run out of money. And we have not heard from either candidate their plan to deal with that and to extend the life of Medicare. And that's something that, you know, Medicare covers more than 60 million people nationwide. So we really have not heard plans on how he would protect Medicaid and Medicare in a second term.
And on the Democratic side, Joe Biden has said essentially that his plan is pivoting around improving the Affordable Care Act and adding a public option to it. Correct, Ryan?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's his big plan. And he has basically said, yeah, what he has called a Medicare-like public option. So anyone who would want to would be able to buy into this insurance plan. And the idea is that it would have lower premiums. It would be cheaper because the federal government would basically be able to use its negotiating power to lower prices. And those savings would be passed on to consumers. This is something that would be available to anyone who wants to buy into it. He has said that he would automatically enroll folks in states that have not expanded Medicaid if they would have been eligible for Medicaid under the expansion, but their states haven't expanded it. They would automatically get the public option premium free. And that, you know, the other kind of goal of this is that, you know, this lower priced option would, you know, by market forces, bring down costs of other private insurance options as well.
I see. Okay. Dan Gorenstein, did you want to say something as well?
Oh, No. Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to give you the chance.
We can talk more about this, obviously. Yeah. Excuse me.
Okay. Well, what about prescription drug costs? Julie Rovner, has Joe Biden indicated that he has a plan to do something about prescription drug costs?
Yes, Joe Biden appears to have a plan for most things healthcare related. But, you know, the main part, and this is the one part on which Republicans and Democrats agreed that they want to do something about drug prices, but Democrats, by and large, would like to basically harness the power of government negotiation to bring down drug prices. Republicans have generally not gone along with that. I should point out, I think I mentioned earlier that President Trump has talked about tying the prices of drugs to an international average. Other countries have price controls on drugs that we don't have here in the United States. Unlikely that the president could do that on his own. But what's interesting is how much that Republicans in Congress will like that even less than the idea of Medicare, of doing our own price controls, basically, of Medicare negotiating. But it's also important to remember when you talk about negotiating the prices of drugs, this is the trade-off again. You can't win in a negotiation unless you're able to walk away from the table. So basically, if the government's going to negotiate, they're going to have the power to say no to some drugs, and some people who might want those drugs are going to be very unhappy. So, I mean, there is, you know, healthcare is just a series of trade-offs. You can't have everything. The late Uwe Reinhardt, famous Princeton health economist, used to say that Americans will consume as much healthcare as other people are willing to pay for. And that was and is is true. And it becomes, you know, you don't want people to go bankrupt paying for healthcare, but you don't also don't want people to, you know, if healthcare is basically free and limitless, the society as a whole isn't going to be able to afford it.
Well, Julie Rovner, we've got about a minute left, but can you talk a little bit about this incremental progress that Joe Biden is planning? Because these steps, you know, building on the ACA, what is this moving toward ultimately? Is this kind of a Medicare for all system that Senator Bernie Sanders has been speaking of, or is it something else? Where are we going?
Well, you know, if there's been this sort of overarching debate between Republicans and Democrats about more government, less government in healthcare, within the Democratic Party, there's been a debate about, do we try to overhaul the entire healthcare system and become like Canada, or do we try to build small, you know, in slow steps on what we have? And Biden is clearly in that latter camp and was throughout the primaries. You know, he was not a Medicare for all advocate. But I should point out that even what he wants to do is sweeping enough that they couldn't get it through when they were doing the ACA and had 60 votes in the Senate. So even his more moderate steps are going to be a big lift to get through even a Democratic Congress.
That's Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News and host of the podcast What the Health. Julie, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Dan Gorenstein, Executive Producer and host of Trade-Offs, a podcast exploring our healthcare system. Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
And Ryan Levy, Producer of Trade-Offs, which has broken down candidate proposals on health insurance, drug costs, and the pandemic. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you, Peter.
And remember, you can go to wherever you get your podcast and search for Trade-Offs and find that, as well as Julie Rovner's What the Health. And you can also find The Exchange if you're looking for it, which is produced by Christina Phillips today. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And just a reminder that NHPR is broadcasting the final debate, the presidential debate, tomorrow night at 9. You can stay tuned for that tomorrow night at 9 and then recap on Morning Edition the following day. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.